nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
I'm going to make a little tweak in the syllabus. I'm going to cover the two topics that were on tap for today and Monday in one lecture, because I think we've been talking about this for a while. We're ready to move on. But then we're going to continue to talk about thermoelectrics. On Monday, I'm going to give more of a research seminar on some recent work we've been doing on thermoelectrics. It's sort of a dry run for a seminar I'm giving somewhere else, but it's relevant for this class, and it comes at just the right time. So it'll be a little, there'll be no new material, but I'll just be talking about some recent research. Okay, so goal is to try to wrap up some of these things that we've been talking. So I hope by now that these equations look familiar with you, to you. These are the standard equations. You can go back to books in the 50s and 60s and you'll see equations like this. But we've developed them in a little different way. You know, so that there's one thing actually interesting. These equations, people will usually say, apply to diffusive transport. Okay. But remember, we derive these things from this Landauer approach. And we can actually make them look like this without making the diffusive assumption. Remember, I just have to replace the mean free path by the shorter of the mean free path or the length of the device, and then it works all the time. Which makes it kind of interesting that you should be able to use these equations for ballistic transport. And I think you can. Maybe we may talk a little more about that later on in the class. But these are the standard equations. And I had this picture of Peltier cooling that I want to say a little more about. Remember, the picture was we have these two contacts. We have an energy channel. The electrons have to absorb some thermal energy, get up in that channel, then they go across, then they dump their energy in the second contact. An electron gets kicked around, goes around the external circuit, comes back in. But let's look a little more carefully at that. You know, how exactly does that absorption of thermal energy happen? So let's look a little more at contact two. Contact one. So here's that first contact. There's the Fermi energy. And here's our energy channel. And how do electrons get up there? Okay. So what really goes on is if I look in that contact, I'm supposed to have a thermal equilibrium Fermi-Dirac distribution. So if I plot it versus energy, the probability of occupying a state is 1 if I'm way below the Fermi energy. It's 1/2 right at the Fermi energy. And then there's that exponentially diminishing tail at higher energies. Those electrons at higher energy, if they're close to the channel and don't scatter much, they have a chance. They have the energy. They can just flow right into the channel, right? So this is thermionic emission. And now I've got a problem. Now I have a highly non-equilibrium energy distribution in what's supposed to be a thermal equilibrium contact. I took a big chunk out of the Fermi-Dirac distribution, and these things are all missing. That's a highly non-equilibrium situation. Now, that's what the contact does. All of the scattering in the contact is going to rethermalize everything and bring that Fermi-Dirac distribution back to where it's supposed to be. So the electrons, what will happen is that electrons will absorb energy and they'll get pushed up and will fill in that hole. That's how the absorption process takes. And you can see that all of this is going to happen in a range, in a region just before the semiconductor that'll have a length that has to do with, you know, how long does it take for, I'll call it an energy relaxation length. How long does it take for energy to change? So if I'm within an energy relaxation length, then these electrons can flow here. They don't scatter and lose energy. Okay. This is actually like a liquid evaporating. You know, if you look at the gas molecules, they have some Maxwellian distribution. A few of them have enough energy to escape the liquid. You know, this is like electrons evaporating out of the contact and going into the device. It's very, very similar physics. And this is actually what happened. So here's a Monte Carlo simulation done by This guy, I guess this was just announced yesterday, Ali Shakiri is coming here as the next director for the Brooks Center. So he's a well-known person in the thermoelectric field. These are some simulations that he did a few years ago, or his group did. So here are two contacts. Now the barrier in this case, these are 3-5 layers, so they can just make different band gap materials. So here's a barrier. And they did a Monte Carlo simulation. Now we'll be talking about this later in the course. It's a way to simulate transport on a computer. So you basically follow electrons as they undergo random walks. Sometimes they absorb energy from the lattice. Sometimes they emit energy. If they see a strong electric field, they get accelerated to higher energies. And you run a million of them and average the results. And it's a nice, simple, physical way to describe transport in detail. So they ran a Monte Carlo simulation of this structure. And here are the results. So what they're plotting here, they could compute, you know, as they follow these electrons, they could compute whether the electrons were sending power to the lattice or whether the electrons were absorbing power from the lattice. And what they found is that they call power dissipation from electrons to phonons. So it's negative here before the barrier. What that means is that the electrons are absorbing energy from the lattice. They get injected in and they undergo some transients in that thin regime. And then they go down into the second contact and it's positive, which means that the electrons are giving energy to the lattice. The spatial extent is the energy relaxation length. You know, they pointed out it's interesting to note, you know, this is not everybody appreciates this, that the cooling actually takes place in the contact layer. We discussed that, I think, last time. Spatial extent is about an energy relaxation length. So, you know, all of the things that we've been talking about can be seen in these very detailed simulations, that this is how the physics works. All right. Okay, so a little bit about these equations. Then we'll talk about an application of the equations and then discuss one or two points. So here are our equations again, you know, written in whichever way we want. You know, I said diffusive people, you know. Yeah, I think with a little bit of care, one could use these for ballistic transport, but they're generally thought of as diffusive equations. And we have these expressions for all of them that look very complicated, but hopefully we're not too intimidated by them. And we can sort of see where they come from and we can use them when we have to. Now, you could evaluate them. So if you have a 1D, 2D, or 3D structure, easiest to do it when we're diffusive. If you assume some energy band diagram, parabolic bands are the simplest. Graphene is just as simple, right? Otherwise, we have to do it numerically. If you assume something about the scattering, and we're going to be talking about this later in the course, but a common thing to assume is power law scattering. So it's the idea that the mean free path is some set of constants times the kinetic energy in units of kT to some characteristic power r. And different scattering mechanisms will have different exponents r. Ionized impurity scattering, r is about 2. Acoustic phonon scattering, r is about 0. So people, when they're working out analytical expressions, will frequently assume that they can write the mean free path in power law form. Okay? Then you can, you know, you just work these things out. And it may not be pleasant, but we can do it when we have to. And, you know, here's the results. So it's not pleasant, but you can do it. And when you have to analyze experiments or you're trying to decide whether this is a good thermoelectric material or not, you just sit down and you work these things out. Now, there's a little bit different way. Those equations look kind of complicated, and you can look at them in a different way that just makes a little more sense. So as we've seen, we can write conductivity as 2q squared over h times the number of channels that are in the Fermi window times the average mean free path. Right? That's just a way of writing this expression here on top of slide 9. That's what that expression is, right, if you rearrange it. Now, we can do the same thing for the Seebeck coefficient. We can make it look a little more friendly. It's just minus Boltzmann's constant over Q, 86 microvolts per degree Kelvin, times the average energy with respect to the Fermi level in units of KT. That's what all that complicated stuff on the last, on the previous slide was. And we can get the Peltier coefficient just from that Kelvin relation, so we don't have to say anything more about that. But we could get the thermal conductivity. So if we start with this expression, if we work that out, we get all kinds of Fermi-Dirac integrals and gamma functions and things. But that's just the thermal conductivity is just the electrical conductivity times temperature times Boltzmann's constant divided by Q squared times, in this case, it's related to the average kinetic energy in units of KT squared. Now, this is a, you know, I have single brackets because that's not really an average. It's the number of channels in the Fermi window. I have double brackets. You know, you had a homework assignment, and that's a specially defined average for the mean free path. This is a different defined average. You know, what is it? This is how the average is defined. You take the quantity you're trying to compute the average of, you weight it by the differential conductivity, and then you normalize. So when I'm doing this average, I'm doing the same thing. Okay. So Seebeck coefficient is related to the average energy. Thermal conductivity is related to the average energy squared. All right. That's what all those complicated expressions on the previous slide mean. And if I want to get the electronic conductivity, I just have to do this relation. Okay. Now, there's something that we ought to know about. It's not surprising that there's a relation between the thermal conductivity and the electrical conductivity, because the electrons are carrying the charge and the electrons are carrying the voltage, the heat. So people will typically write the ratio of thermal conductivity to electrical conductivity as temperature times something called a Lorentz number, which is K over Q squared, times a numerical factor. Okay. Now, actually, that's not quite the Wiedemann-Franz law, because the Wiedemann-Franz law, when people say Wiedemann-Franz law, they're usually thinking about the other thermal conductivity, which is a little more complicated, right? This is the one that you measure under open circuit conditions. And when you do that, you get an expression. And this is what people call the Wiedemann-Franz. I put law in quotations, right? Because it's not quite a law of nature. So, you know, it's worth knowing. The electronic thermal conductivity is the electrical conductivity times temperature times this thing called the Lorentz number. And it depends on details of band structure and energy dependence of the scattering mechanism. But it's useful to remember that under some typical situations, like if your characteristic exponent R is zero, which it is for acoustic phonon scattering, if you have a parabolic conduction band, then if you're non-degenerate, L is 2 times that factor. And if you're strongly degenerate, L is pi squared over 3 times that factor. So people carry these numbers around in their head because they're frequently useful to estimate the electronic thermal conductivity, because it's a lot easier to measure the electrical conductivity. But it's important to remember that it's not a law of nature. And sometimes it's a lot of people think of it as a law of nature, but it's not. You know, that particular ratio depends on all those complicated integrals which depend on band structure and scattering. So like Jerry Mahon says, you should think of this as a useful rule of thumb, not as a law of nature. Okay. So we have these coupled current equations, and we've just been talking about the Wiedemann-Franz law in quotation marks that relates the thermal conductivity to the electrical conductivity, 1 over the electrical conductivity. There is also this Kelvin relation that relates the Seebeck coefficient to the Peltier coefficient. And that's a little bit different, because that is a law of nature, right? That should be exact. And that's, you know, something that comes more deeply from some relations. Whenever you have two flows that are coupled, there is a fundamental connection between the two coefficients that couple those flows. These are called Ansager relations generally. And we're seeing here one specific example, this Kelvin relation. By the way, Kelvin, I guess his name was William Thompson before he became Lord Kelvin, right? So you'll see in physics there are a thing called Thompson effects. I think it's the same Thompson. And then there are Kelvin relations. I think it's the same person, right? Before or after he became a Lord. Now these Ansager relations, so very general, if we were to write the current equations in this form, you know, the first term is the gradient to the quasi-Fermi level. That makes sense. Now, actually, when we were doing that expansion of F1 minus F2, we were really taking the derivative of 1 over T because we were differentiating that argument in the Fermi function, which was energy over T. So really what came in was derivative of 1 over T. That is actually the proper driving force. Because when you derive these equations, if you're careful about doing this, and when you look in books on thermodynamics, they're careful to define what are the correct driving forces. The correct driving forces for this problem are gradients in the quasi-Fermi level and gradients in inverse temperature. Now, it's not convenient in the lab to work with gradients of inverse temperature, but if you define all of the coefficients that way, then one of the things that you'll find is that, you know, let's see, the Ansager relation says that when you define the coefficients this way, L12 is equal to L21. You know, we didn't define them properly, so that's why pi was T times S, you know. If we defined them properly, those two would be the same. That's called an Ansager relation. So the currents, the electrical current or the heat currents, are known as generalized fluxes. The gradients of the quantities are generalized forces. You know, gradient of an inverse temperature or temperature is not a physical force, but we call them generalized forces. And this fact that those two coupling coefficients are equal is known as an Ansager relation. And in general, we'll see later that these things depend on the magnetic field. So it happens in lots of different problems. So, for example, if you have a temperature difference, you're going to have a heat current. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about electrons or something else. You know, if you have a pressure difference, matter will flow down a pressure gradient. Those are two flows that are also coupled. So we would expect then that, you know, there'll be, when there's a pressure difference, not only will matter flow down the pressure gradient, but heat will flow because those two are coupled. And we would expect, because those two flows are coupled, that heat flow per pressure difference will be coupled by the same parameter that couples matter flow per temperature difference. You could write two coupled flow equations for that problem. People do it. And the coupling parameters are the same. So these relations apply very generally. And this fellow, you know, Ansager got a Nobel Prize for working all of this out in a very fundamental manner. He did it from thermodynamics. You know, we're doing it in a very specific case for a specific type of flow, but we're just seeing some consequences of something that's much more general. Okay, so now let's do something with these equations. So let's talk about thermoelectric devices. So here's a device. We've got an N-type layer and a P-type layer and some electrical contacts to the two layers. And let me think about, let's say I've got a flux of heat on the top and I'm keeping the bottom cool. Then I would expect the electrons to diffuse away from the hot region, and I would expect holes to diffuse away from the hot region, both. Right? Now, if I hook a circuit up and put something useful there, like a light bulb or a motor or something, you can see that the electrical current will flow down the P leg. I can have it flow out the contact through something useful, back in, and if electrons are flowing down, that means that the current is going up, and I've completed the electrical circuit. So I could convert heat into electricity through such a device. Okay. And the obvious question we would have is, how much heat can we convert into electricity? And what determines the efficiency of this process? Because this would be very nice. It would be a solid state, you know, power generation system. Okay. Now, you could do something different. We could run current through this. And if we were to run current through this, the current would go up the end leg, which means electrons are flowing down. Then it would go around the contact, and the current would go down the P leg, which means the holes are flowing down. So if I've got electrons and holes both flowing down, they're going to carry heat with them. So the top should get cool, and then they should dump their heat in the bottom, and the bottom should get hot. So I would have a solid-state cooler. This would be called a Peltier cooler. And, you know, heat would flow down, and the questions I would ask, well, how cool can I make the top? You know, how much heat can I pump? What's the efficiency of this process? How much heat can I pump per watt of electrical power that I put in? Questions like that. Okay. So let's see. As I said here, we've talked about the difference between N-type and P-type, and I said there's no need to think about holes, because all of our expressions describe electrons, whether they're in the conduction band or valence band. But sometimes it's useful to think about a problem in terms of holes. So we want to be able to go back and forth, right? Whichever is the simplest. In working out the mathematics, it was simplest to do it all in terms of electrons. Then we have one set of formulas. The explanations I just gave you, it was simplest to think about holes in the P-type. But we must be talking about the same thing. So when I'm talking about electrons flowing in the conduction band, I could also think about holes in the valence band moving in the opposite direction. That's physically, there are electrons moving. So how does that work? If I look at the top, when the electrons are flowing down, they're coming out of the metal and they're absorbing energy and getting into the conduction band. That's the Peltier cooling that's going on at the top junction there. Right. Then they go down to the bottom. They come out of the semiconductor and they drop down to the Fermi level in the metal. They dissipate. They shed their heat. That's why the bottom gets hot. Okay. The end leg is easy. What happens on the P leg? So the electrons, you know, the electrons are flowing in from the metal contact. They have to get to the valence band, so they have to find an empty state in the valence band. Right? Those are going to be around the Fermi energy, right? Near the top of the valence band, where there'll be a few empty states. When they do that, electrons are dropping down in energy. So this side is getting hot, right? It's heating up. Then the electrons flow up, the holes are flowing down. When the electrons get to the top contact, they have to find an empty state. The empty states are going to be near the Fermi energy, so they have to move up in energy. They're going to absorb thermal energy at the top. That's why the top gets cool. And then they flow at the Fermi energy in the metal. So I can think about these problems as either electrons or holes, whichever is more convenient for the problem. Right? You know, physically, what's really happening is I have electrons either flowing through states in the conduction band or states in the valence band in all cases. But a lot of times it's easier to think about it. Okay, any questions on that before we... I don't want to go into a lot of analysis of thermoelectric devices, but I want you to kind of see how it's done. So the easiest way we can do it is we can just take one of these legs and see if we can analyze this thing. So we apply a voltage, we've got current flowing through here, and we want to see whether we can analyze this thermoelectric device. Now, for this problem, it's going to be important to realize there is some resistance in this. There's some I squared R loss. You know, I don't have a short, almost ballistic regime where all of the dissipation occurs in the contacts. I've got these conceptual contacts here where the inelastic scattering occurs. So I've got I squared R losses distributed throughout there. And on average, I'm going to assume that half that heat that's generated flows down and half of it flows up. Right? There's no reason for it to prefer one versus the other. So if we want to analyze this device, the way we would start is we would say, okay, let's see if we can set up a balance equation for the amount of heat that's being pumped at the cold side, Q sub C. And that's going to be equal to the heat that's pumped by the Peltier effect. So there's current running through here. So that's pumping heat. But I have to subtract, you know, I'm pumping heat, so the bottom is getting cool, the top is getting hot. That means heat is going to want to flow back from hot to cold. So I have to subtract the heat that's diffusing down due to that thermal gradient that's being developed. Okay. And then the whole time some I squared R losses are happening inside the device, and half of them are coming down. Okay. So I have the heat coming in, and that's due to the Peltier effect, but then I have to subtract the back diffusion and I have to subtract the I squared R losses. So I get this little balance equation. You know, this is the Peltier heat that's pumped. QC has units of watts per meter squared. So that's my current density. This is the backflow from the hot side to the cold side. Kappa includes both the electronic part and the lattice part, but it's mostly the lattice part. And this is half the I squared R loss. So you can see if you crank the current up, you're going to pump more and more heat, but you're going to get more and more I squared R losses. Eventually, the I squared R losses are going to win. So there's going to be some maximum in the amount of heat that you pump. So we can just take the derivative and find out what's the maximum heat that we can pump. That'll tell us the current at the maximum that we put back in here, and that tells us the maximum heat that we can pump. Okay. Now, if I'm pumping the maximum heat and this top side is getting hotter and hotter, then eventually that backflow will cancel the heat that I'm pumping and I won't get any net heat pumped. That'll give me the maximum temperature difference across these two devices. That would be a useful thing to know. You know, what's the biggest temperature difference that I can get across here? You know, can I cool it down to liquid nitrogen or whatever? And if you do that analysis, you can just work through it here. The answer turns out to be very simple. You know, now in practice, we'll have all kinds of thermal transport coefficients between this side and the air, and everything is much more complicated. But in this simple little analysis, the answer is very simple. It's one half some combination of material parameters called Z times the temperature at the cold side squared. Okay. And this set of material parameters, Seebeck coefficient squared times conductivity divided by kappa, occurs over and over again in these problems. So it's been given a name, Z. And it turns out people will call it the figure of merit. You can see that the higher it is, the bigger the temperature difference I can produce. Okay. So these are all the parameters that we've been talking about, and you can kind of see that, you know, the Peltier coefficient is proportional to S, so I'm going to pump more heat if this is big. If the conductivity is high, I have lower I squared R losses, so I'm not generating heat in there, so I want to make the conductivity as high as possible. But I don't want heat to be diffusing back. I'm pumping it up. I don't want it to be diffusing back down, so I'd like the thermal conductivity to be as low as possible. Right. So it makes sense that the parameters come in that form. Okay. So we could go through another analysis, and I don't want to go through this, but you know, we could compute the efficiency. So we could take the maximum heat that we could pump, and we could divide it by the input electrical power, I times V, and we could find what they would call the coefficient of performance. And if you did that, the expression is a little more complicated, but what you'll find is that the the material parameters appear in the same combination we saw in the first case. Okay. Now, it's not quite true when you get in more detail. Now, Harsha has discovered this. But to first order, the material parameters always come together in this same combination. And if you do an analysis of the power generation, and you want to find out what's the efficiency, how much electrical power can you get out versus the heat power that you're putting in, you'll find that it's also given by an expression that involves the material parameters in the same combination. Okay. So that's nice. So you can go looking for semiconductors, and you can look for the ones that have the biggest Z, because those will be the semiconductors that are most useful for these kinds of applications. Okay. So the units of Z are inverse Kelvin, and you know that's not so convenient. So people usually describe, people usually work with a dimensionless figure of merit, Z times the temperature, you know, the average temperature you're working at, because that has no units. So that's a dimensionless figure of merit. And the higher it is, the more efficient a device can be. And we just want to talk a little bit, you know, what kind of material properties are needed to get a high one. And if you have a material, how do you dope it so that you get the optimum ZT, for example? So we just look at the numerator and at the denominator. And the numerator has an S squared in it. And we know, you know, we've seen that S basically is determined by the location of the Fermi level with respect to the band edge. Conduction band for N-type, valence band for P-type. And it's pretty similar for almost everything. So the only way you really do much with S is by doping. Conductivity, well, you need to have a large number of channels. So if you put the Fermi level up in the conduction band where there are a lot of channels, that helps. Or if you find a material that has a large effective mass, remember the expression for the channels was proportional to the effective mass, that'll have more channels. You need a long mean free path, so you want low scattering. All right, so that's pretty straightforward. The lattice thermal conductivity, you know, there is a chapter in the notes where we talk about that. You want a low lattice thermal conductivity. So people will look for materials that have heavy atoms and have low sound velocities because that's the velocity that the heat is being propagated at. That's something, if you're interested in learning more about that, you know, have a look at chapter 9. So I think I mentioned earlier on, you know, this Russian physicist Iofi realized in the 1940s that semiconductors could have useful figures of merit and you could actually do something with it. And they sort of looked around for semiconductors and developed materials, and they found a class of materials that had figures of merit, dimensionless figures of merit, about 1. And that happened in the early 50s. And people worked very hard because they thought, if we could just get this up to 3 or so, you know, it would be tremendous. You could have all solid state cooling in your refrigerators. You could take all of this waste heat that's generated in industrial processes and turn it into electricity. It would be enormously important. But it's proven to be enormously difficult. ZT was 1 from about 1950 till about 1995. Now, recently, there started to be some progress, and people are enthusiastic about it again. I'll say a little more about that on Monday. So let's say we have our material. We still have to decide how to dope it so that we get the most ZT out of it. Doping is just going to affect the numerator. That's all. Okay. So, you know, if you dope it lightly, then all the electrons are going to be near the bottom of the conduction band. I'm going to have a big difference between the average energy of current flow and the Fermi level, so I'll get a good Seebeck coefficient. But I won't have many channels occupied to conduct the current, so I won't get much conductivity. Okay. Now, if I dope it heavily, I've got the Fermi level way up in the conduction band where I have a lot of channels, I have a good conductivity. But when I'm way up here, it's like a metal, and the current wants to flow where DFDE is non-zero. That's right around the Fermi energy. So when I'm heavily doped, the average energy at which the current is flowing is close to the Fermi energy, which means I get a very low Seebeck coefficient. So we expect the optimum to be somewhere in between. And that's basically what you see. If you plot Seebeck coefficient versus Fermi level, we see heavily doped semiconductors and metals have small Seebeck coefficients. Lightly doped semiconductors have large ones. If you plot conductivity, you've got to get the Fermi level up close to the conduction band or into the conduction band to get some conductivity. So the product of S squared sigma is going to look something like that, known as the power factor. So you end up doping the semiconductor so that the Fermi level is somewhere around the bottom of the band. Then you still have a Seebeck coefficient that's reasonable, and you're beginning to get a reasonable conductivity. So that's how you do that. Okay. All right. Then I just have a few miscellaneous loose ends to wrap up. Any questions before we dive on? Friday afternoon. All right. One or a couple of other. These are our basic equations that we're familiar with now. Now, I'll just mention some things quickly because we're going to need them later. So I've done everything in one dimension to make life easy. Okay. I could write these equations in vector notation like that. Just make everything a vector. Right. I could write them in indicial notation. That's just another way of writing these equations. Instead of writing this as E vector, I just display the components. I is X, Y, or Z. Partial with respect to I is just the way of writing the gradient, ddx, ddy, ddz. Okay. So those are just, you know, ways of writing our equations. But in general, you know, conductivity, Seebeck coefficient, Peltier coefficient, thermal conductivity, these are not scalars. Right? We've been assuming they were. In general, they're tensors. So if I write the equations like this, you know, if I just look at how the electric field is related to the current density, it's not rho times current density, it's some matrix, right? There are 9 components. And depending on the semiconductor and how complex its crystal structure is, a lot of these could be non-zero, and you could apply an electric field in one direction, get a current to flow in another direction, temperature gradient in one direction, current flow in another direction. All kinds of things can happen. Now, we can write these equations as, I could write this matrix vector product this way, but what people will usually do is they won't show the summation sign. We'll just write this as rho sub ij times j sub j. And that's a convention called the summation convention. So whenever you see a repeated index, it just means you're supposed to sum over it. So you let J be X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3, whatever you're labeling your coordinate axis. It's just a shorthand way of writing that matrix product. Okay. So our transport equations really look like this. They're much more complicated than the ones we've been talking about. And when I taught this course 10 or 15 years ago, or 20 years ago, we spent a lot of time on the tensor properties of materials and how we determine which terms are zero and which terms are non-zero. But we have other things that have become more important now. If you're lucky and you're working in an isotropic material, like silicon, germanium, you know, their bands, you know, the conduction band, you know, you have these ellipsoids that have different masses on different directions, but they're oriented along the three coordinate axes. When you average everything out, everything is isotropic. Whatever direction you point, you always have the same combination of effective masses and things. So in that case, everything is nice and simple if you have an isotropic semiconductor. we'll find out in a little while that even if you take an isotropic semiconductor and add a magnetic field, it's no longer isotropic. Now you start getting off diagonal terms to the resistivity. And that's where Hall effect and things come in. So we'll have to learn how to deal with those. All right. So now if we have an isotropic semiconductor, then the tensor is just a constant times this Kronecker delta, which is 1 whenever I is equal to J. All right. So just as I said, if you're working with common cubic semiconductors and under low fields, then the transport tensors are isotropic. If you apply a high electric field, then the transport can be, now you're off equilibrium, but we're going to be talking about that later. But if you apply a high electric field, then things are different in the direction of the field than in the other directions. So these transport tensors can become non-diagonal under high fields too. And if you ever need to deal with this, you know, you can find lots of mostly older books where this is all worked out, and you can find the, you can look at any of these tensors and you can find out which elements are non-zero, which elements are equal to which other elements. And when you need to work out those, you know, this is a good place to start, but they're usually a set of older textbooks where this has all been worked out in detail. Now, if you have to compute these, it's probably easier to do it by solving the Boltzmann equation. We'll solve the Boltzmann equation in a few lectures, and you'll see it's just kind of natural to compute the tensors. It just drops out of the solution of the Boltzmann equation pretty easily. Okay, another... I'm just wrapping up some loose ends here. Let's talk for a minute here. Let's say you want to go into the lab and measure the Seebeck coefficient. Right. So conceptually, it's easy to do. We're looking down on the film. We've got a couple of contacts. If I can heat one up and measure the voltage, the open circuit voltage between the two contacts, then I can get the Seebeck coefficient. So people will build in maybe a resistive heater on one side and run current through it to heat up one side so that I have a temperature gradient. And then you have to do something so that you can measure the temperature on both contacts, put a thermocouple down, make sure you have intimate thermal contact. But there's something here that we have to be careful about. That we have a temperature difference across these two contact, so we'll get a Seebeck voltage. That's what we're trying to measure. But our voltmeter has one of its legs connected to the hot contact. The other one is probably sitting out here in the ambient at the same temperature as the other contact. So there's a temperature difference between the end of the lead that's on the contact and the end that's on the voltmeter. If there's a temperature difference across any material, there'll be a Seebeck voltage. So when I do this measurement, I'm going to have a Seebeck voltage of the lead and a Seebeck voltage that I'm trying to measure. So we just need to be careful. If you look through the signs, the measured voltage is the difference, is the one we're after minus the volt drop on that lead. The volt drop that we're after is related to the Seebeck coefficient of the semiconductor, but the volt drop of the lead is related to the Seebeck coefficient of the lead. Now, if it's a metal, it'll be small, but when experimentalists are careful, or when they're measuring Seebeck coefficients that are small, they're always careful about this correction. So what you'll find is if you just see what it is that you actually measured, you're actually measuring the difference between the Seebeck coefficient that you want and the Seebeck coefficient of the metal lead. Right. So, something to be aware of. Now, what about the valence band? So, we've been thinking of these equations as, well, we said it may apply to an N-type semiconductor where all of the channels are in the conduction band. It may apply to a P-type semiconductor where all of the channels are in the valence band. What if the temperature is high enough or the band gap is small enough that you have channels in both bands at the same time? Okay. So that's actually not a problem because we know how to compute the channels in the valence band. We know how to compute the channels in the conduction band. So we know the total number of channels, and it doesn't really matter where they are. All right, our expressions work all the time. We just integrate from deep in the valence band, where that minus df dE is zero, to deep in the conduction band, where it's also zero, and we include all the channels, wherever they are. Okay. So, how would you do conductivity? We would integrate from deep in the valence band to deep in the conduction band, and we would take the total channels, add the valence band channels to the conduction band channels. Okay. Now, this is pretty easy. I could split this integral into two parts. The integral from deep in the valence band to the top of the valence band is just going to give me the conductivity of the valence band, right? The integral from the top of the conduction band up to hot, deep in the conduction band is just going to give me the conductivity. So the answer is simple. We just add the two. We get the conductivity of electrons plus the conductivity of holes. It gets a little more interesting when you ask what's the Seebeck coefficient. So here's our general expression for the Seebeck coefficient. And again, we're just integrating the differential conductivity from deep in the valence band to deep in the conduction band. The total number of modes will be inside of this. The conductivity just adds. That's the one that we just saw. Now, when I do this, I could split this integral into two parts, deep in the valence band to the top of the valence band. And then the second part is deep in the conduction band edge to deep in the conduction band. Now, I could divide this by the integral of the conductivity just over the valence band, and then multiply by sigma p. And I could divide this just by the integral of the conductivity in the conduction band, and then multiply by the same thing, which is sigma n. Okay. Then what I've got in each of these is going to be sigma, I have Seebeck coefficient for the conduction band times conductivity of the conduction band, plus Seebeck coefficient of the valence band and its conductivity, divided by the total sigma. So it's a little more complicated. It's involved. You can see that if you're at a high temperature and you had equal numbers of electrons and holes, and if their mobilities were equal, then you would have a negative Seebeck coefficient for the electrons and a positive one for the holes, and if the conductivities are about the same, you'd have zero. Right? They would just cancel each other out. But since there's a mobility difference, it just gets a little different. Okay, what if you're looking at the thermal conductivity? So here I'm not going to work this one out. I might assign it as a homework problem if I'm looking one for some time, because this one gets more interesting. So you would expect that the total thermal conductivity will be the total electrical conductivity times temperature times this Lorentz number, but it'll be a total Lorentz number. And you might guess that the Lorentz number would be this thing that we talked about before for the conduction band plus the Lorentz number for the valence band. It turns out it's much, much bigger than that, right? Which is very interesting. And it comes out of the math. The words that people use is they say it has to do with the energy it takes to excite an electron hole pair, and that energy is really part of the heat transport. I'm still not completely comfortable with that explanation, but it all comes out of our math. So, and you know, these are things, people have worked this stuff out long ago. If you want to find discussions for lots of these problems, you have to go back to old textbooks. These guys have forgotten more than we know today. So there's a lot of gold in some of these old books. Okay, so that's about it. You know, I hope you're really, really comfortable with these equations now, because they're very important. That's what we've been talking about for a couple of days. And as I said, I'm just going to give more of a research seminar on Monday that are related to these topics, but there won't be any new material, so you should be able to follow it pretty easily. And we will be ready Wednesday to move on to something new. I think we talk about scattering next. You know, we've just written down this mean-free path, but we haven't talked about it. Okay, are there questions? Yes. Good, you're not.
When you were working out this maximum in the temperature, the difference temperature and efficiency, it looked like the maximum temperature difference depends only in one of the temperatures.
That's a very good question. You know, why did the, your question is, when we found delta T was one half the temperature of the cold side times this figure of merit, the temperature squared, right? Why cold, why is there a preference for the cold side versus the hot side? That would also make a nice homework problem. You know, I think that happened because we did all our bookkeeping at the cold side. And remember, S and sigma are temperature dependent. They refer to the S and the sigma at the cold side. If you worked it out at the hot side, I think you would, your answer would come out to be the temperature at the hot side. But you would have to use different Seebeck coefficients also. So I think it was, a lot of times when people are doing these calculations, they will use the average temperature between the two sides. Because, you know, when you plug a Seebeck coefficient into that expression, you have to ask, you know, which temperature am I evaluating my Seebeck coefficient at, the bottom or the top?
And that was going to be the other question.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions? All right. We'll see you on Monday.